I've ever sung that song. It's nice to go into a new fellowship of Christians and learn new songs. And I marvel that you've been a Christian for, I guess 30 years practically, and you guys seem like you knew that one real well, but I've never heard it, so that's neat. Thankful for all who are here tonight for the opportunity to speak. I'm thankful to the elders and for your being here. And always grateful. You're not required to listen to me. I'm nobody special. I'm just a servant of the Lord. But so I consider it very gracious to always have an invitation to share these things. I know these are on my heart, and opportunity is greatly appreciated. The message, I guess, of John 2 through 4, we might even throw 1 in there, is very simple. It's essentially, let me introduce you to Jesus, the Son of God. He wants to bless you with heaven's richest blessings, but in order to receive them, you have to be born again. And by the way, once you've received those blessings, the last thing I want you to do is sit back and bask in your own salvation and just enjoy these things without any regard to others. So there's a story that's developing here in John. And so chapter 4 is all about evangelism. It's all about sharing the word. And I'm really excited to hear about what you guys have going on in classes throughout the week. And I was talking to Adam tonight. He said one of his goals is to just get the members in public and comfortable with the idea of being in public rather than behind these four walls, to get our faith out where people are. And that's an endeavor of mine in Northern Kentucky. I'm learning new things already from Adam about new ways to open up opportunities and to spot them and to create those things. And so thankful for that already. You know that John 4 has Jesus calling us to that great work in verses 34 through 38. It says, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. Do you not say there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they are already white for harvest. And he who reaps receives wages and gathers fruit for eternal life, that both he who sows and he who reaps may rejoice together. For in this the saying is true, one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap that for which you have not labored. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labors." Jesus calls us, and this is our lesson on an invitation to reap. Just as chapter 2 had an invitation, chapter 3 also, we're being invited into the labor. And I think it's really neat that just as Jesus was sent, verse 34, him who sent me to finish his work, we also have been sent into this work. He's called us here to go do it. Every disciple, when he is perfectly trained, will be like his teacher. Jesus is our teacher. Jesus was called to do this. He engaged in the work. If we're going to be like Jesus, we're going to take up this mantle. Another exhortation from the text in verse 35 is that it's an urgent invitation. It's not something where we can we have the luxury of putting it off until the future, when we may feel like at which point we will be better prepared or suited for the task. And so that's the danger of saying, look, there's still 4 months. I don't know what it might be in your mind that you need in order to do this, but you don't need to be a scholar in order to share the good news. I'm mindful of the time that Jesus told a man who had been demon-possessed and recently saved from that condition, he wanted to go and follow Jesus, and he said, no, I don't want you to do that. I want you to stay here and tell what great things God has done for you. He didn't know much of anything about the Old Testament, but what he did know is he knew that God has been gracious to him, And this is what God has done for him. And I think any of us who are saved can tell our story about what God has done in our lives. And I love that the same chapter which calls us to lift up our eyes to the harvest is also the same chapter that provides a how-to, right? There's a case study here. Jesus is the powerful example of how to carry out this work. So it's not like we've been left to our own devices. Jesus provides a wonderful example, and I just think this seems like such an unlikely story to have transpired. Like the story about this tired traveler who encounters an immoral woman in a hostile city, and he speaks to this immoral woman, and somehow he is able to transition the conversation from, why are you talking to me, to, this might be the Messiah. You know, come and see, this might be the Messiah. So how did he do that? Are you marveling, as I am, that Jesus, in the most unlikely place, with the most unlikely person, is able to transition this conversation in such a way? How did he do that? That's what we want to seek to understand. How did this take place? And I know that you, like me, probably at times have assumed that, you know, whenever you've struggled to find contacts, that, well, maybe I'm just not looking hard enough. I know that's not the case for me. But one of the things that I learned from John 4 is that maybe it's about looking low enough. Maybe not as much hard enough, but just low enough. I know that I've made the mistake of I have this life goal of reaching people, and yet possibilities come and go very, very easily. In fact, this would have been something that easily could have passed him by. And yet he somehow is aware of the opportunity. So I know sometimes when we're in conversations with people, it's very difficult, because it's kind of like boxing, I think. Sometimes conversations with unbelievers is like boxing. You're trying to get in, and then, you know, you got to be kind of like that light on your toes boxer, where you're kind of just all over the place. You're trying to look for your opening, really, right? It's like there's a lot of defensiveness there. There's a lot of hesitation and nervousness. You're feeling each other out. There's not trust there because you don't know each other. And so you're weaving in and out, looking for your opening. And Jesus shows us just how masterfully he did this, and also shows that it's really not as difficult as we make it out to be. There are five things about this interaction that I think are crucial, even for today, that we can employ. And the first of which is that Jesus had a blatant disregard for the cultural barriers that existed in that day. The first of which was her race, of course. So Jesus, as a Jew, spoke to this Samaritan woman, and her response was, Jews have no dealings with Samaritans, and therefore, how is it that you are asking a drink of me? Now, Samaritans were particularly hated because they were considered a mixed race. That was the responsibility of the Assyrians, who repopulated Samaria with a mixed multitude of people in order to... this is back in the days of 2 Kings 17, where he would take captives and repopulate nations in order to steal away their nationalism, that nationalistic spirit. And so the Samaritans were considered a mixed race of Israel and were hated as a result of that. The Jews had a saying, and that was, according to William Farrar in The Life of Christ, that if one met a Samaritan walking along the road, one should walk into the ditch to avoid contact even between the two shadows. I don't know if you ever hate someone so bad that you don't want your shadow to have anything to do with that person's shadow. That describes the hatred that they had. There are other things about them we'll talk about in just a moment. But when it says, the text says that Jesus needed to go through this place. When all the Jews would have taught, you go around that place, the text says that Jesus needed to go through that place. I want you to think about this for just a moment. You think about this claim that Jesus needed to go through Samaria. What does it say at the beginning? He left Judea and departed again to Galilee. You would say, well, it looks like Samaria is right in the way of that. If you haven't found that yet, Samaria here, Galilee here, Judea here. It would seem that you would need to go right through, but that wasn't the case because some do explain it as being merely a geographical necessity. But I don't think that's why it says he needed to go through Samaria. Listen to what the pulpit commentary has to say about that. There was no physical necessity about it. He might, as bigoted Jews were accustomed to do, have crossed the Jordan and passed through Perea instead. There was also a route along the Mediterranean to the west. So it's customarily, that's what they did. They avoided Samaria. Here it says he needed to go through Samaria. Why? Because he was in such a hurry. Chapter 4, verse 40. Does it sound like Jesus is in such a hurry that he needed to go through Samaria? It says, when the Samaritans had come to him, they urged him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. He stays 2 extra days. If he's in such a hurry that there's just no other way around, and he needs to go to Samaria, well, then why did he stay 2 days? I want to suggest that he needed to go to Samaria, not because geographically and time-wise he needed to do it, but he needed to do it because he knew that there were good hearts there. He knew that he had people, just like he says of Paul in Corinth, I have many people here. And he was able to make a conversation about living water apply not just to this woman, but that there were many in that city who believed. Verse 41, chapter 4, many more believed because of his own word. Another of the cultural barriers that he did not allow to create a division between he and her was her religion. Verse 20. Is clear that there is a religious divide. And we know that the Samaritans, they didn't accept the prophets as the word of God, just the books of Moses as being of divine origin. But here in verse 20, there's this ongoing religious feud that is the first idea to come up. I mean, this is tantamount to the thief on the cross argument, right? I mean, if you teach much at all, you hear the thief on the cross and why that can't be God's plan of salvation you are teaching. This is the first thing that comes to her. All right, let's get something squared away. You Jews say this, our fathers did this, what's the proper place to worship? And of course, religious hostility between the two groups was such that there was actually a time when the Jews burned down a temple, and 2nd century BC, read about that. And it wasn't just the Samaritans' religion that Jesus had to contend with. Here's another quote about from Rabbi Eleazar, who taught that eating bread of the Samaritans is like one who eats the flesh of swine. And so while culturally he's being told to avoid this woman, he doesn't allow himself to allow this wedge to be created just because of the traditions of his people. Concerning her gender, there was another point. This is a woman of whom it was said, again, this by Jerem Bars, learning evangelism from Jesus, rabbis did not have women as disciples. Women were not allowed to be witnesses in court, for the rabbis considered women to be irrational and untrustworthy. Forgive me for even saying it. That doesn't fly in our day and time. Thankfully so. There was a prayer uttered by the Pharisees. Thank you, God, that I'm not a Gentile but a Jew, that I'm not a slave but am free, not a woman but a man. A Jewish maxim said, never speak to a woman on the street and burn the words of the law rather than teach them to a woman. R.C. Foster, Studies in the Life of Christ. It's remarkable. It's remarkable the disdain that they had for women. I can't explain it. I can't understand it. Yet Jesus honors this woman. He honors all women. He honored his mother. He honored others. I mean, he had grace and compassion for the woman who was sick, who had the issue of blood. My daughter. I mean, he speaks to them with the kind of love that you would have anticipated the Creator would have. And he calls her to discipleship as well. He didn't allow her reputation, verse 18, to create a wedge either. When he confronts her about her husband, saying, you have no husband, for you've had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband, in that you spoke truly. Five times divorced. In those days, to have been divorced five times. A woman, when she was divorced, it wasn't like, well, what happened here? Let's get to the bottom of who's at fault. You're just, as a woman, you were at fault, and that contributed to your reputation. She would have been viewed in society as someone who was sexually available. She was, you could pretty much, you could just have this woman as a man if you wanted to. And she would have had no reputation, very low social status, obviously hated by other women for what she had become. He even says, the one you have now is not your own. And so what? Here's this living in fornication. This isn't America in the 21st century. This is a long time ago in society that didn't look very highly at this sort of thing. And you can imagine some might say, Jesus, what are you talking? Not only to her because of who she is, but that she's a woman and she's that kind of woman. You would think that maybe the argument of just what might people think when they see you perhaps by yourself at this well, you know, some have suggested that a woman like this would probably try to avoid large crowds. I don't know if that's the case or not, but just the appearance of talking to a woman like that might be something that was cautionary and ill-advised. Again, Jesus did not allow that to become a division. Jesus instead revealed that he was not willing to discriminate on any of these points. And 2 Corinthians chapter 5, I think, reveals the attitude of why this is the case. This should define our new way of thinking about people after we have become Christians. Therefore, verse 16, from now on, we regard no one according to the flesh. Even though we have known Christ according to the flesh, yet now we know him thus no longer. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. Jesus did not regard her according to the flesh, not her gender, not her race, not her religion, not her fleshly sins. Didn't regard her according to the flesh. He saw her as lost, someone who was thirsty, someone who needed the living water that he had to provide. Jesus also teaches us a great example of initiating a conversation with a stranger. Let's go back to John 4. Here he is at the well. He's really tired. You could really have excused him or justified him to just have some me time after a long day's journey. Verse 6, wearied from his journey, he sat by the well. It was about the sixth hour. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, that's remarkable, especially today, especially in our day and time in which we are becoming more and more isolated from each other, right? We don't even, lots of times, we don't even have to look at who is really there. They're just like behind covering. Not only that, but oftentimes they have AirPods in, headphones in, they're glued to their phone. I mean, you look at people on like a bus or like a, public transportation, they're just to themselves, right? It's unhealthy, right? There's even ads on the radio coming out trying to teach kids about the importance of having friends and you know, interacting with people. We just don't do that much as much anymore because of our society. We need to break down those walls, because this story happened because he was willing to talk to a stranger. Jesus at the well said to this stranger, "Give me a drink." And so his eyes were open to possibilities around him. I wonder if we might think about in the morning. We wake up, we don't know what the day has in store for us, but are we thinking about these kinds of interactions? Are we praying about who God might lead into our path today that we might otherwise have just completely missed if we weren't watching for someone to come within our sphere of influence? There would have been nothing more ordinary about him just sitting, resting, waiting his turn. But he interrupted the ordinary and did something extraordinary in that he spoke. And you might be thinking, you've seen that picture there, you're on an airplane, oh great, they're going to talk to me. They're gonna ask me questions, right? Oh great, I have a talkative hairstylist. Great, you know, can't she just be quiet and get the job done and leave me alone? We should have our heads somewhere else than just wanting to have me time. We should be all about conversations with others and connecting and interacting with people. Jesus shows us that's how this was able to take place. You might say, I'm not a good conversationalist. Well, what did Jesus, what brilliant pearls did he have to share initially with this woman? But the request for a drink. I mean, this all started with a simple request, give me a drink. What about the conversation that could be started with your neighbor? Is there anything like this that with your neighbor you could say, you did this kind of like Jesus did? Might it be a request for help just like Jesus offered? A request like, hey, can you give me a hand with something over here? I'm trying to lift this into my truck. Okay, you've never met your neighbor. You go introduce yourself and say, I got something. You might say, oh yeah, that doesn't look very good. I mean, the first time you're meeting him and you're already asking him to do something for you. Well, the experts call that impression management. Those who know refer to it as a supplication as impression management, where you're actually making yourself vulnerable to this stranger. And you're putting yourself out there and say, I need something, and I need your help with something. And most people are willing and anxious to do that. Think about how Jesus uses this in his ministry. Remember Zacchaeus. Come down from there. I need a place to stay. He invited Zacchaeus to let him be hospitable and house him. I mean, Jesus is the creator of the heavens and the earth, every drop of H2O that this planet has, and he can't get himself a drink of water. He has to ask, can you give me a drink? Maybe there's something to this here. Hey, you know if your neighbor is handy. You know that he's always under his hood. Hey, my car's making this noise. Could you come listen to this and see? Yeah, I mean, they're not gonna. If they're not inclined to do that sort of thing, then they're not inclined to do it. But you never know what door that kind of thing might open. And it just wasn't a conversation for conversation's sake. He looked for this transition. Okay, he's in one moment talking about giving me a drink, and in the next, it's if you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, give me a drink. You would have asked him and he would have given you living water. It's not just conversation for conversation's sake. There's a transition here. Also, we need to have our eyes open for those kinds of transitions, okay? Natural transitions. Talking about the Lord often is very helpful, but when you have someone talking to you about how much they like your house, you're just always interjecting the Lord into that kind of conversation about how he's blessed you. Oh, you've got such great kids. I'm just really impressed with your kids. Yeah, you know, Proverbs has been very helpful or something like, or this Bible class at church one time, we had it on raising kids. I learned the neatest things. You're just always looking for ways of interjecting your faith, your Lord, what you learned, what you read recently in the scriptures. And that's what Jesus did. We're talking about a drink of water, and all of a sudden we're talking about living water, which will quench her every thirst. I know one time I had an opportunity come from a neighbor who had a Bible in his windshield. You know, up on the dash, I could see the Bible. All of a sudden, there's this made-to-order conversation, open door created because, you know, here's this Bible. Other cars have little ichthus fishies on the back, right? Little religious symbol indicating this person is open to religious conversation. Others, you know, they might not be religious whatsoever. You're still looking for conversation transitions. Also, in his teaching, we see that he spoke to her need. He didn't start in the middle. If he'd walked up to this woman and says, by the way, you do know that you Samaritans are going to hell because you're not worshiping right, probably wouldn't have the kind of reaction that he got. Obviously, she has some issues. Jesus even says, you worship what you do not know in verse 22. He didn't avoid that conversation, but he also didn't start in the middle. I want to give you an example of this in Mark 4, verse 33, where Jesus says, Mark says of Jesus that with many such parables, he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it, right? That reminds us of John 16:12, also where it says, I have many things to tell you, but you're not able to bear them now. Jesus recognized that there was this all in good time sort of principle that governed his conversation. He spoke to her deepest need, which was she needed this living water, verse 10. But he did so in such a way that it challenged her, right? He uses this metaphor about living water that you have to know he knew would be hard to understand. That she would have to say, give me this water that I may not thirst nor come here to draw. She misunderstood. He would have known that she was going to misunderstand that. He chose to use it anyway. That's why he's a master teacher. And so he challenged her. He tested her love for truth, her willingness to seek truth and not be dismissive about this. And so we have a lot to learn in the way he piqued her interest and caused a seeking heart to want to learn more. Also, willing to convict sin in that he... All the while he is willing to speak to her need, he's also not willing to neglect these difficult issues, like the issue about where the proper place to worship is. It says, we would add his willingness to, or his unwillingness to, compromise. This is my final point I wanted to share. Preaching the truth without compromising and willingness to convict sin is so important because the Spirit said that when he comes, he would convict the world of sin. Jesus does that here. The husband you have is not your own, and you're worshiping in ignorance because salvation is of the Jews. He doesn't try to sweep that under the rug. He doesn't try to divert attention from these differences that exist. I'm impressed by the fact that Jesus had a definite conviction on the truth about proper worship. And he was willing to come out and say, y'all are wrong about the way you're worshiping. Because Deuteronomy chapter 12 is very clear that verse 5, God would choose a place where his name would dwell, and it's there that you should worship. Jesus had studied that out. Even at 12, he's studying and learning and growing, and he's learned that one, and he had a position about it. So his willingness to convict sin is also seen here. The importance of it is seen in Acts 24, 25, where Paul, as an example of this, preaching to Felix, what is he reasoning with him about? Righteousness, self-control, judgment. Every one of those has a moral, spiritual component to it. When we preach and teach the gospel, there has to be a need to respond. We have to show that need, that this is applicable to you, that all men have sinned, and you probably have committed some of these sins here. I love watching this man on the street kind of interaction. There's evangelists that go on the street, and they talk about how, yeah, I'm a pretty good person. I feel like if I died right now, I'd be saved. And, okay, well, it's on the, based on them being a good person. And then this guy asks these questions like, okay, you're a man, right? And you're a red-blooded American man, right? Have you ever lusted in your heart after a woman? Oh, okay, yeah, I guess I've done that. Well, you know what Jesus says about lusting in your heart for a woman? You're guilty of adultery in your heart. You know what adulterers get? Have you ever lied? Oh, yeah, I guess I've lied. You know what liars get? You show the need and the conviction of sin, and you can't preach the gospel without that or with a desire to compromise. All right. One other thing that's, I think, interesting about this is that even though he wasn't willing to compromise the truth about worship here in 21 and 22, he also did not feel the need to be argumentative and pick at every little thing that might have been a little out of place in her conversation. Like chapter 4, verse 12, if he'd been the type of guy that just kind of latched on to every single thing that was a little askew, when she says, our father Jacob gave us this well, and are you greater than him? Our father, he could have latched onto that, and as a good Jew might have done, said, what do you mean, our father Jacob? Don't you mean our father, the true Jews here? You're just kind of a mixed race sort of Samaritan, and you say our father like he's your father as well. You're kind of like an orphan. You're kind of adopted. He could have latched onto that, just like we can latch onto so much of what is said by people that don't really study a whole lot of their Bibles. They talk about, well, I feel like the Spirit is leading me here and there, and he's doing this and that, and you're thinking, Spirit. How do you know that that's the case? You want to say, I'm not sure. And yet, when it comes down to it, you don't know that the Spirit didn't lead that person to talk to you today. Maybe he did. We might want to criticize that way of speaking, but we don't know that the Spirit didn't make that happen, just like he did with Philip and the eunuch. And so we let it go. I've gotten really tired of trying to correct people about, no, I'm actually not a pastor. Pastors have special kind of qualifications, 1 Timothy 3. I'm an evangelist, and it's like, and they don't get it. They keep calling me pastor. It's like I'm realizing here probably going to fix itself if we can get some of these bigger issues resolved. And Jesus really struck at the heart of the matter here and did not criticize the nitty-gritty of her conversation. So in conclusion, I guess the takeaway for us is that I'd love for us to take with us would be we need to develop the same appetite for God's will as Jesus did. Verse 34, do not say, I'm sorry, verse 34, my food is to do the will of him who sent me. I would to God that all of us would think that way, that what am I doing today? What is my food for the day? It's to lift up my eyes and see who is in need. And what we've seen in this is a blatant disregard for barriers that divide us, initiating conversations, speaking to the need, confronting the problem of sin, and not compromising, and lovingly so, but not compromising the truth. So what I'm calling you to do is to be aware as you sit in the classroom, you sit in your break rooms, You sit at the barber's chair. You sit on the sidelines of your child's sports team. That you're looking for opportunities for simple conversations. Give me a drink. Or, hey, you want to go in on the snack schedule with them? I mean, you're just looking for the simplest end that you can get your foot. And you're developing a relationship, just like Jesus did with Zacchaeus. Giving thought to the conversation. We're going to meet people who aren't interested. Of course, this woman, if she didn't have a good heart, could have had any reason to resist Jesus. She could have said, verse 7, oh, typical Jew thinking I am his servant, asking me for a drink. Why didn't he say, please give me a drink? He's so entitled, right? If you don't have a good heart, you can do that. Verse 14, having offered water that quenches forever, she could have thought, well, this weary Jewish traveler has been in the sun just a bit too long. What a weirdo, right? Talking about living water. She could have easily dismissed him. After identifying the moral shortcomings in verse 18, you know how she could have responded to that if she didn't have a good heart. Who do you think you are? Or my personal favorite, you don't know me. Who do you think you are judging me with all of this? When he taught the truth about worship in 21 and 22, you Jews think you're the only ones going to heaven, don't you? I love how you can so easily brush aside centuries of my people's tradition with a sweep of your hand, just dismissing our religion. Again, you think you're the only ones who are saved. There's always going to be a reason to complain or resist or something like that. If somebody is of that nature, that's not our fault. This woman just as easily could have done it to Jesus himself. But she had a good heart. So we're going to have to put ourselves out there. Recognize we're going to fail sometimes, but there are good people out there. And we need to take a chance to have that conversation. I'll bet there are instances where you've had conversations with strangers about things that mattered far less than this, right? I know that others have done that to me, and it's always awakened me. I know the one guy standing in a Walmart aisle, we're standing in front of like automotive chemicals, right? And this guy just starts talking to me about how good this product is. Oh, you need to put this in your gas tank every so often. It's good. This is good stuff right here. I'm like, you're preaching the good news. You're preaching the good news of auto care. You're talking to a stranger about it. That's a wake-up call. You ever have that happen? I want you to feel real bad about that if you're not talking to people about the Lord. But hope that's a helpful thought to you. Appreciate your time. Know that I went a little over tonight. Maybe I'll give that back to you during the week. That's your incentive to come back during the week to the meeting. I want to appreciate, again, your kind attention. I'm going to sing a song of encouragement. Now, are you coming to Jesus tonight? If there's anyone in the audience that needs to respond, like this woman and her fellow citizens, many believed. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, you may. You may confess that faith. You may be baptized for the forgiveness of sins. If you're subject to the invitation, come forward now while we stand and sing.